always really been very interested in community. Community's kind of my pet topic and pet thing. And I've really felt that our individualistic society has kind of kept us isolated and kept us away from the benefits of the community that's always around us. And we've kind of gotten to a situation where we have ignored or failed to recognize the relationships that can be had between our neighbors and other people around us. So I was kind of searching for a way to build a place or to be in a place where I both knew my neighbors and my neighbors wanted to know me, and that we could take advantage of the gifts that we all brought to each other. So I was having a conversation with some friends over breakfast a couple years ago. And we sat down and we were talking, going on and on about about the problems that we felt there were with our isolation, that kind of thing. And this conversation lasted forever. We eventually came around to the idea, well, what if we lived close together? And what if other people lived close together with us? And we all thought, well, that sounds pretty cool. I wonder how that would happen. And we kind of left the conversation kind of festering in us. A few months later, the Oregonian, which is the Portland area newspaper, printed an article in their real estate section. And this is actually a copy of the article, talking about Trillium Hollow, which is a co-housing group at that time that had just purchased land and was getting ready to build co-housing. And the four of us thought, this is cool. And we all investigated it, checked out a few other groups, and then dove in head first, because it was almost a mirror of the conversation that we were having. And I later found out that that's not uncommon for people who get into co-housing, to have thought of the idea before and then just wondered where it existed. So, in September of 1996, four of us dove in. What was real interesting about that, the four of us, is that the one person in particular, Tom, came from a background where his father was a physician and he had lots of money and he was used to living in suburbia and really used to being isolated, and he liked that. That was pretty cool to him. And so initially he didn't really feel that co-housing was for him. But as the conversation grew and as he became part of Trillium, of the four of us, he dove in almost more than anyone else. He became the minute writer and had a wonderful time with that and led some committees. He was actually chair of what we call the Geek Committee, the people who were responsible for internet connections and things like that. So, Trillium Hollow just finished building. They moved in June of this year. So, but I want to tell you a little bit about how co-housing came to be and what it actually is. In the late 60s in Denmark, there were a few dual family incomes or dual income families who came together because they were frustrated. They felt that sending their children away to childcare was not helpful. They felt that knowing their neighbors would be helpful. And so they got together and they built the first co-housing neighborhood. And the Danish word is something that I can't pronounce, but translated, it means literally living communities. And so in 1972, they built their first place. And now in Denmark, this is considered a very common way to live. It's one of those things when you think about, well, am I going to live in an apartment or a house or co-housing? And co-housing can take the form of either apartments or houses. We'll get to that later. So in the 1980s, Chuck Durrett and Katie McCammett went to Denmark, and they're both architects, and they fell in love with the idea of co-housing and brought that back to the States. They wrote a book, which is the first book that I've listed there, Co-Housing, a Contemporary Approach to Housing Ourselves. And they, being architects and community builders, brought those two pieces together. And they really felt, as I feel, that our architecture reflects who we are as a community and how we shape that. So the first co-housing community was built in California. It was either Davis Street or N Street. I don't remember exactly which. And since that time, 1989 is when they moved in, there are, I would say, probably about 40 other co-housing neighborhoods in the United States that are built, and about 200 that are in some stage of development. And that number is constantly growing. There were a lot, last summer, there were a lot of people who were starting construction, and so there are a lot of groups that are just moving in now. So the co-housing movement has gone from what I would call infancy in the States to a period of adolescence, this kind of awkward figuring out what the next step is. Any questions so far? Yeah.
Is it kind of like a middle-class commune?
Well, it depends on what you mean by commune. My family used to joke that it was Julie's commune. And I'll get to this a little bit more. One of the things that I distinguish between a commune and co-housing is that a commune, generally people share living space, kitchens and bathrooms and things like that. That doesn't happen in co-housing. In co-housing, you have your own home, and it's your space and your sanctuary, and it's highly regarded and respected.
Are most of them in cities or country?
Most of them are in cities because they found it's easier to build in cities than in rural areas. Though there are a lot of people who really would like co-housing to be more rural. The people who tend to be attracted to co-housing like the country. But zoning laws make it a little difficult for that to happen. Because in the rural areas, the zoning laws are designed to keep things spread apart. And co-housing, and I'll get to this more, co-housing tends to try to put homes densely together and then use the rest of their land for other purposes.
The only problem, for the reason I came, we've got one starting in Dallas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in Garland. And although the church is being torn down, there's rooms and they have room for about 20 houses, but I'd never heard of it before that. They've got a little model and everything in the library, and you can see what it will look like eventually. I think only 9 or 20 or so. But when I saw it, I thought, well, this is great, but where else are we going to find that much space within Dallas, you know, to put 20 houses from scratch?
Yeah.
You know, when they've got the area in the middle and that's the problem. That's the reason I came. I just
wondered
how they're going to make this happen without the land that they need to put this in.
Getting the land is typically the hardest part for co-housing groups to get through. And we can talk a lot more about how that happens. So Chuck and Katie, people who brought co-housing over, kind of made some principles for how co-housing happens. And kind of divided it, I guess, into community and architecture. And again, I really do think architecture reflects community. And so we'll go through the community things first. So we've got community. Okay, first big thing in community is that it's a participatory process. And usually that takes the form of being consensus-based. So, and we can talk a lot more about what the dynamics of that. It also means that people are expected to take responsibility for the community and for themselves. Complete resident management. You know what that means. And what that usually means is that the residents of a co-housing community are responsible for taking care of grounds, bathrooms, and those kinds of things. They don't hire another organization to come in and manage the co-housing process. And then I have another one that I've added my own here. I also believe that it creates room for individuals. And I think this is a really important piece of co-housing, because I talked about our individualistic society before, and I think it might be foolish to think that we could just get rid of that. And there are definitely benefits to respecting our individuality. This also means that you have your own home, and your own home is your sanctuary, it's your place to be, and that's very respected. You may have to set your boundaries by shutting your blinds every once in a while, but that's your space. The architecture place area, there's an intentional design. So the buildings and the grounds are designed around keeping community, around interactions with people. And there's also common facilities. Usually that takes the form of a common house. And in the common house, there's usually a large dining hall, a place for children to play, a library, also things like some groups do large television sets and an entertainment room. But going back over these, I want to talk a little bit more in depth about them. So we've got the participatory process, consensus. How many of you are familiar with consensus-based processes? But one of the primary things about consensus is that the group consents to decisions being made. And consenting and agreeing are two very different things. In agreeing, I think of this is a decision that I would make on my own. In consensus, you're consenting to a decision is this is a decision that I feel will be good for our community. Or will. Sometimes, though, you consent to a decision being made that you wouldn't make on your own, and you may not think is the best decision for the community, but you don't think that it will cause the community to fall apart. Somebody want to let that chipmunk up?
She tried to lay down her original name when you were at the door.
Must be hungry by now.
Oh, there's a screen. It's not that hard.
So, we're operating a project of this size on, in a consensus-based process is a challenge. It's, yeah.
When you say size, how many people are you talking about?
Usually, the co-housing groups tend to be between 12 families and 36, and somewhere in the middle is optimal. So it tends to be about 65 to 100 people. Many of those are families. During the development of Turling Hollow, we had probably about 30 people at each of our business meetings. And that number steadily grew as we worked on the project. So Holden is a place that's operated by consensus. And there are some definite similarities there. I think there is a major difference, though, in that like the Holden Winter community is consenting about life together as a community. Building co-housing, you're doing consensus on a $5 million project. And there's a lot of emotion that goes with that kind of money. Groups learn throughout the process of building co-housing how to do consensus. At first, it can be kind of rough. And it requires that you take responsibility for yourself. And that if you feel like somebody has stepped over the line or insulted you or hasn't understood you, you have to take the responsibility for telling that other person. And that is a huge piece of getting along well in co-housing. And it's part of the selection process, self-selection process. Usually people who aren't good at taking that kind of responsibility for themselves don't end up in co-housing. It's just not the place for them to be.
How strong is the leadership? I mean,
well, it varies from group to group, but people who are good at consensus tend to be leaders. And so you end up with a community of people who are used to being in leadership roles. So you tend to have people who naturally rise to the top in most organizations as leaders. In co-housing, you have a lot of people doing that and very few followers.
Too many chiefs and not enough Indians?
That can happen. They definitely can.
Are they making decisions about the design and things right from the beginning, or is there kind of a standard design that these architects have put together?
There are some principles of design that the architects have put together, but not any standard design. I'll get into the overall process a little bit later, but they are, typically they are definitely making decisions about the design of their own individual homes and of the community at large. And those are interesting conversations to have because people do get real tied to how things are designed. But the hardest consensus decisions are around money. And I think that's pretty obvious. It's where people take their risk. Any questions about consensus? So in complete resident management, talked a little bit about that. It's pretty self-explanatory. Basically means that co-housing people take responsibility for the property they live on. And we found that there were people who were very interested in doing tasks that others were not interested at all in doing. One of the members was a custodian with the school district, and he loved doing plumbing things and taking care of a lot of those tasks that are not my skill, certainly. We had another member, Bob, who was 74, and you'd never know it. You would think he was in his early 60s, who was really into digging trenches. He was very good at it and was very good at leveling things in a trench, so he chose to do a lot of that. And it's great. One of the things that we found in complete resident management is that in the process of taking the property we had at Trillium and making it, getting our occupancy permits, we had to do what's called a non-native invasive species plant removal plan. Say that 5 minutes fast. That required that we remove all of the blackberries off the property. And there were blackberries everywhere. Out of 3 acres, I would say that a third of it was blackberries. And they were in along a steep bank along a creek, and it was amazing. But in the course of about 10 work parties and a lot of community building, we got those blackberries out. So,
did you have to replant them somewhere?
No.
You just had to get rid of them?
Yeah, we had to get rid of them. They were Himalayan blackberries, and they are very invasive. They'll take over anything.
Was that your choice to take them out, or like buying the land required that you take them out?
In order to get our occupancy permit to move in, the Washington County required that we remove them.
Okay.
We could have hired somebody else to do that, but it would have been a lot of money. And we got the opportunity to build community.
Is Trillium 3 acres?
It's 3.6 acres.
Okay. And how many people are on it?
A total of 29 homes.
That sounds nice. Okay. Two and a half acres with one house. I had 2.5 acres with one house. That,
yeah.
29 houses sounds like a lot.
Yeah. In creating room for individuals, again, it gets to that knowing your boundary thing. But one of the things that we would commonly say in our meetings, in our business meetings, is that everybody owns a piece of the truth. And that in each individual had something to offer to our decisions, to building the community. And that would be different for each person. Bob's gift was digging trenches, among many, many other things. Louise was great at making meals to keep us going. I did a lot of meeting facilitation. So there were definitely lots of ways that people could plug themselves into. And very little is required. And hopefully you're even involved in the process of deciding even what is required. The requirements tend to be around things like the expectation that you work in a work party once a month, or the expectation that you may make a meal, an evening meal, once a month. But again, being a community and participatory process, you're involved in deciding those kinds of things and what works for you and what doesn't. Any questions?
The cooking is done in common, then? One person or two, three people cook for everybody?
Well, it varies. Different communities do it differently.
Okay.
Typically, co-housing groups will have 3 to 4 meals together a week. And typically they have 2 or 3 people who decide that they are going to make the meal for that night. And that gets real interesting. Some cooks are better than others. And again, everything is optional, so you can kind of figure out if you're a good cook or not by your attendance. So it creates room for a lot of creativity. There was a group in the Seattle area that's kind of known for its gourmet cooks. They really get into that piece of it. We had one person who was interested in Trillium Hollow who was a baker. And he was looking at an upstairs home. And the kitchen in that upstairs home was on the top floor. He'd have to carry his flour up a flight of stairs, and he was a little concerned about that. We let him know, though, that if he's going to make goodies, that we will carry the flour up and even help carry the goodies out.
Did you build for just the people that originally invested in it, or did you build more than that?
We built more than that. Trillium Hollow was started by 12 people. We call them the Dirty Dozen. Or actually 12 families who, and I'll get into that a lot more later. And they built, their target was 20 new homes, pretty much from the get-go. So you build on the faith that you'll find the people. And it works, which is something that's incredible to me. An intentional design, usually there are three components to how co-housing is designed. Well, more than that. Let's say that this is your plot of land. And let's say you have a little creek running through it, that kind of thing. In a typical development, you would break this into a grid, and each person would get their plot of land. The kitchens would be all facing away from each other, and they would be designed for isolation, really. It's just the way it goes. Co-housing, usually the houses are clustered together. With pedestrian pathways through, and the activity centers of the house are facing each other. So that when you're walking down that pedestrian pathway, if somebody's in their kitchen working at their sink, they can see you going by. It makes things much safer. And also has some other interesting effects that I'll get to later. Usually also parking is put off to the side. Cars kind of tend to isolate us, so they're moved away from the community. This is a piece that a lot of co-housing places have trouble with for practicality reasons, because there's usually older members or people with families, and getting groceries from parking lot to home can be a challenge. Trillium ended up being built on top of the parking structure, which was helpful to a lot of people. So we've got activity centers facing each other, pedestrian pathway and parking, and also, let's make this a different color, a common house, but centrally located. And what happens, or what you're shooting for, is one of the things that you're shooting for is that when you get out of your car, you walk, let's say you're walking to this home, you pass by or almost everyone in your neighborhood, and it creates opportunity for conversation to happen. I was up at Trillium on the 4th of July, and just in the process of walking around to a couple of friends' homes, so many people saw me that it took me probably about half an hour to get from point A to point B. There's also another person who was making cookies, and he didn't have any vanilla or any brown sugar. So he went to the first neighbor and got the brown sugar, and that took him half an hour because he got into this great conversation. And then he went to the next neighbor when he found that he didn't have vanilla, and that took him an hour And then I ran into him, and we got into a long conversation, so we never did actually make the cookies. And then also, in the Common House, usually they try to put the mailboxes there so that people are brought through that area, making it an activity center so that you can go there and hang out. Kind of like the dining hall here. It's a place where a lot of people pass. And that gets me into common facilities. The Common House is a community center, and takes, in some in co-housing predecessors, which are a little bit different, there were commonly what's called a common house or whatever. And they tended to have a little bit of difficulty in keeping that a place that's alive. And so that's one of my concerns about the future co-housing. How do we keep this a focus? And how do we continually bring people through there? And I think the meals are a really good way to do that. Any questions about that?
It's really just like having a covered dish night two or three times a week or something.
Yeah. For me, I like to cook every once in a while, but I don't like to do it all the time, and so I really like the idea of having a place where dinners meet. One of the things I love about being here at home, dinners meet.
Do you have any single people?
Yeah, lots of single people. The age ranges are actually quite incredible. At Trillium, I was the youngest member, and the oldest member was 84. And that's actually quite a range. Usually families, young kids, teenagers, and kind of thing.
Do you have a kind of a covenant that spells out all the requirements, bylaws, whatever it is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I brought some samples of things that we did, things that another group in Portland did. And we'll get to that in a little while.
Are the homes different sizes then, say, a single person comes in?
Yeah. We ranged from having studios that were about 600 square feet to four-bedroom places that were about 1,600 square feet. One of the things I forgot to mention is that as co-housing grew in Denmark, they created what they called the first, second, and third generations. First generation, they created homes that were normal-sized and a small common house. And as co-housing matured in Denmark, the common houses became larger and the homes became smaller. And that's one of the things that we tried to keep in mind at Trillium, is that we're looking at living in a smaller space here because we have this other place to go to.
Washer and dryer in each individual one, or?
That varies.
That varies.
Yeah. A lot of places have a centrally located laundry, but also the option to have your own. Mm-hmm. I think young families with kids tend to opt for having one in their own home. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about the timeline. Because there's definitely a process that people go through. Okay, so I know it's here. We start out in ABS. And I'm going to come back to these. We get to covenant. Then to purchasing land. Design. Building. And moving in. And there are definitely a lot of things that happen after move-in. I'll touch on that a bit. My experience is mostly with this process here, but I've definitely looked at a lot of co-housing groups that are moved in, so I'm familiar with that part too. So co-housers start with the ideas. You get a bunch of what's commonly called a burning soul. People who say this is something that needs to happen. This is a ripe opportunity, and we have the people here to do that. And at that time, there's really very little financial involvement. And people are real idealistic at this point. I think this is all going to be warm, fuzzy, perfect sorts of things. People who tend to start co-housing are often not very concrete thinkers, but they have a lot of motivation. Then realities, and throughout this, we're moving from ideas to concrete, almost literally. Actually, quite literally. So there's reality slowly sets in with this. But I think there is still this undercurrent of idealism that I think is fuel for creating good community. So from ideas, they move to covenant. And typically what happens is that they will spend probably a weekend in a workshop coming up with values and a covenant. And this is an example of one that a group in Portland did. It talks about things like, one of the things here is that there'll be a community of friends, that they value the experience of knowing and trusting neighbors, and value a sense of extended family, and they value their social time together and recognize that interpersonal relationships are an instrumental part of our community. So that's kind of the theme of the covenant as far as the value section goes.
It seems a lot like living before the television set for people that are my age and older. I mean, our neighborhood, you know, everybody played, everybody came out, and just kids played without being worried about them, and adult parents talked, and then the TV came in.
Yeah, and I think TV has really been a huge detriment to our society.
Yeah, and everybody just went in and never came out again.
Yeah, and so what I think we've had to do is almost force that kind of interaction here, because people have forgotten how to do it.
So if somebody wants to move in, you have an interview committee that interviews a potential?
Usually there's what we call a clarification committee. Co-housing is a self-selecting process, and it's legally required to be that because of equal housing opportunity laws. But self-selection works. People tend to kind of get an idea of what co-housing is about pretty quick, and if it's not for them, they decide to move on. But the clarification committee clarifies with those people about making sure they really understand what they're getting into.
So you're not choosing them, they're choosing after they hear everything whether this really fits, but actually by the time you've told them everything, you kind of are selecting, right? I mean, what I mean is, like, if they went along with everything that you're talking about, they would be a person that would be good for your community.
Right. But we're also required not to disqualify people.
Right.
though, that does get into the interesting question of what if there's somebody who is not safe in your community? And there are ways to deal with that. And we actually had a situation like that at Trillium. Typically, it involves a conversation with that person, letting them know how you personally feel about that situation. You can't take the voice of the community in that type of situation. In fact, generally in community, you need to speak for yourself and not for the whole group, which is something that people learn as they go along.
The person who wants to sell their residence, mm-hmm. and the clarification committee kind of interviews the potential buyer?
It's an interview process.
So unless they go through that, then the seller couldn't sell that person?
No. If you really wanted to bypass that process, you could. It's nothing that's legally set in stone. It's a helpful process around passing information. And I think that a buyer going into co-housing would probably want to go through that anyway, just so that it's as much clarification for the community as it is for the individual. So that the community can know who this person is and how to welcome them, how to bring that person in and make them feel at home. But because it's a self-selecting process and because of the Equal Housing Opportunity Laws, we can't make stipulations about how it must happen, but how it's helpful to have them. Typically, though, co-housing places, once they move in, have a kind of a waiting list of people who are interested. So when you sell your home, if that's something that you need to do, you have a group of people to go to sell it to. So we got covenant. At the time of covenant, too, communities decide how they're going to financially work this out. And there are two tracks that can take. That can take the what's commonly called the brutal method or the developer-driven process. The brutal method is being your own developer. And that means buying the property on your own, hiring the architects, going through the design process, going through the legal stuff, all on your own. And the other way is to hire a developer to do that for you. I would highly recommend the latter. Having done the brutal method and having seen the developer-driven method, I can tell you this for certain. Typically, people in co-housing have a lot of energy and big leaders and gung-ho about doing everything, and they're usually really, really, usually they don't have a lot of experience in development. And I think a lot of money is wasted that way. Trillium, the way Trillium happened at this point is they decided there were 12 families at that time who were in a position to be able to mortgage their homes, do a second mortgage on their homes because they owned them free and clear, come up with some money to buy some land, and then fund the process that way. The hardest part about doing the brutal method is getting the money together. And Trillium was unique and very lucky in that regard. As co-housing matures, development money is more available. You had a question? So then you move to buying your land. And as we talked earlier, buying the land is the hardest part about co-housing. Because it requires that your group make a huge decision. 2, it takes a lot of money. And 3, land can be hard to find. What a lot of groups do, what Trillium did, is that they found a piece of land that was on a wetland. And because they chose to centrally locate all the dwellings, they were able to fall within the boundaries of that wetland. A typical developer would not choose that piece of property because they couldn't divide it up. There's another group in Portland that chose a piece of property that's got an apartment building already on it. And their plan is to renovate that building and to build other buildings around it. So there's a lot of urban renewal.
So they are doing that.
Mm-hmm.
What's so funny, a friend and I talked about 10 years ago or longer, getting a big building and mm-hmm. having the community room and having an apartment. So I didn't know that we were doing that, so that's
yeah.
great.
Yeah. It's actually a real common way. Another way that happens that's actually a lot more difficult than you might not think so first is to take a neighborhood block and to remove the fences and build a common house in the center area, or use one of the houses as a common house. And that has the advantage that your activity centers of your home are usually in your backyard, and so you have that just inherently. Your cars are removed because they're on the outside, and have your common house. The difficult part about that is that buying a whole block is hard to do.
Hmm.
And people tend to run into that. I need to hurry along here. Then you design it, and it's a participatory process. If you're working with a developer, the developer will help you with that, which is probably preferred because people can get into really amazing and amusing arguments about colors, things like that. You build it, and then you move in. And the process of building is huge externally in that there's a lot going on, but the community isn't terribly involved with that, generally. Though some groups do choose to buy a plot of land and then each individual build their own home. And in that case, you're as involved as you want to be.
What happens if the building is all going on? How do you decide how it's getting paid for?
Well,
all the units are different sizes and...
Yeah, you go through a process of choosing how much each home is worth. And that's typically done like any other real estate. You do comparables in the area. And you figure out how much it's going to cost you per square foot, and then how much you want to charge per square foot.
And then how much of the land it's sitting on? I mean, if the 12 families are the ones that had the money to buy the land, how do you chunk up the land cost?
Yeah, what happened there is that the 12 families invested about $1 million and bought the land. The land was then mortgaged. And then, in order to get enough money to get a construction loan, subsequent members were asked to make their down payment up front. So 10% of your expected cost was what was required for membership into an LLC. We've created a limited liability corporation. And by investing your 10%, you became a member of that. And then after the occupancy permit was received, then you would get that 10% back to make your mortgage. And then those mortgages would then go to pay off the construction loan. And that's actually a very common, that's the way that the houses are generally built. A developer would have been the one to invest this money here. And they would also not have required the 10% down payment. They would have required a much smaller investment up front. And then you would do the standard mortgage thing. So in that regard, using the developer makes a lot of sense too. Move on. I'm going to move on to talking about what happens in this kind of community, because I think that's a real interesting part, and we don't have much time left.
Could I ask one question?
Sure.
For a home that's 1,600 square feet, how much are people paying, like if you were a new person moving in?
At Trillium Hollow, we built in a very expensive part of town, and each four-bedroom, I think, was $200,000, maybe a little more than that. And the studios that were at 600 square feet were about, let's say, 80,000. So who's the typical co-houser? Typically, well-educated, white, middle class, people who are familiar with roles of leadership. And there are lots of reasons for each of those. Well-educated because these people, I think it probably plays into the leadership thing. They're people who like to think a lot. White, because I think it's mostly white, because I think white people have not figured out community as well as some other cultures have. And they've already got it. And middle class, because it requires you to buy your own home. There are groups that are working on building lower income housing into co-housing, and a lot of groups who really want that piece of that. It's hard to do. You have to get grants, HUD money, and those kinds of things. And I think as co-housing matures, that will happen a lot more. Tend to be professionals. At Trillium, we had a lawyer, a doctor, four people in computer industry, a scientist, teachers. And again, I can't stress enough that these are people who really take charge of their lives. And that creates an interesting dynamic, because these are all people who are used to leading, and so they don't want to follow. And so when you, when it comes around to making a decision, there are a lot more people who want to be a part of making that decision than you might have expected. So it's real important in the decision-making process to make that open. Relationships in co-housing. People find their relationships are changed a little bit. Specifically, things like couples where there's an introvert and an extrovert tend to find co-housing is a great place for them, because the extrovert can always find people. And the introvert doesn't always have to have the extrovert around. You can always have their own space. Again, that requires that people know that about themselves, though. In fact, there were several couples that were involved at Trillium where you could see their relationships actually got better over time because they were allowed to have that kind of interaction. Children tend to get co-housing quicker. They know how to do it. Like you were saying before television, people were already doing co-housing. To a large extent, I think children already are. And I think we take a lot of clues, or a wise co-housing group would take a lot of clues from the children about how to do it. Parents find that their kids make fast friendships, and that they don't have to keep as close an eye on them because they're in a safe environment. And non-parents get to do a little bit of parenting. Becomes an interesting dynamic because non-parents have to figure out how to do that in a respectful manner. Lots of groups actually have several conversations about what's appropriate and what's not. How do we tell kids that this is an unsafe place to be, that kind of thing. We actually did a 4-week course on parenting as a community with lots of non-parents there. You'll find people who will challenge you quite deeply. And I think you find that at Holden too. You run into some amazing people who will affect your life. You'll also find obnoxious people. You can't get away from obnoxious people. One of the things, though, that people have learned over time is that the size of your community is going to help a lot with dealing with who you may deem to be obnoxious. If your community is too small, you're going to be running into that person all the time. You don't want that. That's neither good for you nor them. If your community is between 60 and 100 people, you have enough of a buffer that that obnoxious person can be on the other side of the room from you. But also, it creates an opportunity for you to figure out how to deal with that in a helpful way. Moving on to sustainability. Co-housing, I think, is, as far as I'm concerned, is a real sustainable way to live. Just by the fact that Denmark has been doing it for 30 years now. Sustainable in some people's mind means the same people over those 30 years. And it doesn't mean that to me. Holden is a very sustainable place, but we have a lot of people who keep coming through. And it's very different than it was 30 years ago. Co-housing places stay sustainable by making room for new people to come in. But there is always a time of transition when a person leaves. And there's a mourning that goes on. And there's also a process of welcoming in the new person, finding their gifts and talents and welcoming them. So, I'm a little bit over time, but are there any questions?
Is there a comprehensive list of all the co-housing communities in the United States?
There is on the co-housing website. This is the most current information that's available. These are two great books. This one is good for introductory sorts of things, talking a lot about community and architecture. This one, which I have right here, is great for how to actually do it and some things to take note of there. And then this website is the Kelly Hollow website. And I think it's actually pretty out of date. Mm-hmm.
Are there any of the communities that choose to be, enclosed, fenced for safety of kids in the community?
Most of them don't. Mm-hmm. They usually rely on the fact that there are always people around. Mm-hmm. In fact, I heard a figure the other day that about 60% of co-housing residents are usually home because a lot of them work from their homes or they're retired.
Do you have a picture or something?
I do. I do have some things here. Here's some basic marketing materials on a group in Portland. Articles and some pictures. There are some pictures in this book that you're welcome to look at. And then there's condominium documents and things like that. I failed to mention that the legal structure is usually condominium legal structure because that's the simplest way to do it. So finalizing that kind of stuff. You're welcome to look for them. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. I hope to have some other things, but this is just what I brought with me.
That sounds interesting. I have meetings.
Yeah, there are a lot of meetings.
Yeah, I don't know. Are you happy? You like it? It's better than your former way of life.
I really do like having a community around. But also, meetings don't bother me too much. And usually they don't bother me because I try to facilitate. They do bother me.
I mean, I love it here, so I'm happy about that, but...
Well, I would encourage you to...
I have my own house. I hope I keep it until I have to get out.
Yeah.
But it certainly is an interesting concept.
Yeah.
What states are there mostly?
Mostly along the West Coast. There are some, quite a few up in the Minnesota area.
Where in Minnesota specifically, rather than Minneapolis?
No, you would need to look at the website. Yeah, but that's for, these are just my notes.
So it's sort of,
Yeah, I have a hybrid effect.
Well, this one, that's the reason I was having she had a picture. This one that has the little model, the only difference I saw was that the streets, there are no streets that go through. The house is all open onto a common yard line.
Yeah, actually, Trillium ended up being, it was an interesting progression there. They ended up doing, starting with the idea of doing duplexes closely in close proximity. As the budget became tighter, it ended up being a large building with individual condominiums in it.
Well, what's wrong with Dallas? You've got